Party is over.
Hey, it's Cassie.
Hey, it's Shelby, and we're from Chatham.
You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM.
Acre, Catskill, and Hudson.
Listener-supported hands-on radio.
For Greene and Columbia counties. Have a nice day.
Yay!
If you are hungry or just want to help community radio, come on out on Thursday, May 25th to Left Bank Ciders in Catskill to their community soup night. WGXC is organizing this night, Thursday, May 25th, with a live on-site broadcast, DJs, and soup. Come on out for a bowl of soup, conversation, and some music. Each Thursday night, Left Bank Ciders hosts a community soup night where volunteers make soup with proceeds benefiting a local nonprofit. All proceeds go to Waveform's WGXC 90.7 FM. On Thursday, May 25th, the Left Bank Ciders in Catskill from 5 to 7 p.m.
Survive All, one of the nation's leading manufacturers of fallout shelters, now combines sturdy steel with durable.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies. Once again, you maybe not once again, you're listening to your host, Norman Douglas. And the show is called Goodnight Norman right here on WGXC. 90.7 FM in Hudson, Catskill, Acre. WGXC.org on the Wild World Web. Tonight I'm going to read a story by by Sarah. Holy smokes. Pinsker. The title of this book is Sooner or Later, Everything Falls into the Sea Stories. Comes out of East Hampton, Mass.'s Small Beer Press. Sarah Pinsker, P-I-N-S-K-E-R. This first story is called A Stretch of Highway, Two Lanes Wide. Andy tattooed his left forearm with Lori's name on a drunken night in his 17th year. Lori and Andy forever and ever was the full text, all in capital letters, done by his best friend, Susan, with her homemade tattoo rig. Susan was proud as anything of that machine. She'd made it out of 9-volt batteries and some parts pulled from an old DVD player and a ballpoint pen. The tattoo was ugly. It hurt like hell. And it turned out Lori didn't appreciate it at all. She dumped him 2 weeks later, just before she headed off to university. 4 years later, Andy's other arm was the one that got mangled in the combine. The entire arm, the entire arm, up to and including his shoulder and right collarbone and everything attached. His parents made the decision while he was still unconscious. He woke in a hospital room in Saskatoon with a robot arm and an implant in his head. Brain-computer interface, his mother said, as if that explained everything. She used the same voice she had used when he was 5 to tell him where the cattle went when they were loaded onto trucks. She stood at the side of his hospital bed, her arms crossed and her fingers tapping her strong biceps, as if she were impatient to get back to the farm. The lines in her forehead and the set of her jaw told Andy she was concerned, even if her words hid it. They put electrodes and a chip in your motor cortex, she continued. You're bionic. What does that even mean? He asked. He tried to move his right hand to touch his head, but the hand didn't respond. He used his left and encountered bandages. His father spoke from a chair by the window, flat-brimmed John Deere cap obscuring his eyes. Means you got a prototype arm and a whole lot of people interested in how it turns out. Could help a lot of folks. Andy looked down at where his arm had been. Bandages obscured the points where flesh met prosthetic. Beyond the bandages, the shine of new metal and matte black wire. The new arm looked like their big irrigation rig, all spines and ridges and hoses. It ended in a pincer, fused fingers, and a thumb. He tried to remember the details of his right hand, the freckles on the back, the rope-burned scar around his knuckles, the calluses on the palm. What had they done with it? Was it in a garbage can somewhere, marked as medical waste? It must have been pretty chewed up, or they would have tried to reattach it. He looked at the other arm. An IV was stuck in the forever of his tattoo. He thought something far away was hurting, but he didn't feel much. Maybe the IV explained that. He tried again to lift his right arm. It still didn't budge, but this time it did hurt, deep in his chest. Can't prosthetics look like arms these days? He asked. His practical mother spoke again. Those ones aren't half as useful. You can replace this hand with a more realistic one if you want, but to get full use of the arm, they said go with the brain interface. No nerves left to send the impulses to a hand otherwise, no matter how fancy. He understood. Well, how do I use it? You don't. Not for a while. But they were able to attach it right away. Used to be they'd wait for the stump to heal before fitting it, but this, they said, they had to go ahead and put in. You don't have a stump anyway. His father chopped at his own shoulder as an indicator. You're lucky you still have a head. He wondered what the other options had been, if there had been any. It made sense that his parents would choose this. Theirs had always been the first farm in Saskatchewan for every new technology. His parents believed in automation. They liked working the land with machines, gridding it with spreadsheets and databases, tilling the fields from the comfort of the office. He was the throwback. He liked the sun on his face. He kept a team of shires for plowing and used their manure for fertilizer. He had his father's old diesel combine for harvest time, his biggest concession to speed and efficiency. And now it had taken his arm. He didn't know if that was an argument for his horses and tractors or for his parents' self-guided machines. The machines would take out your fence if you programmed the coordinates wrong. But unless your math was really off, they probably wouldn't make it to your office. On the other hand, now a pincer, it had been his own stupid fault he had reached into the stuck header. Andy's world shrank to the size of the hospital room. He stood by the window and read the weather and fought the urge to call his parents, who were taking care of his small farm next to theirs in his absence. Had they finished harvesting before the frost? Had they moved the chicken run closer to the house? He had to trust them. The doctor weaned him off the pain medications quickly. "You're a healthy guy," she said. "Better to cope than get hooked on opiates." Andy nodded, figuring he could handle it. He knew the aches of physical labor, of days when you worked until you were barely standing, then a shire shifted its weight and broke your foot, and you still had to get up and work again the next day. Now his body communicated a whole new dialect of pain, aches wrapped in aches, throbbing in parts that didn't exist anymore. He learned to articulate the difference between stinging and stabbing pains, between soreness and tenderness. When the worst of it had broken over him, an endless prairie storm, the doctor gave the go-ahead for him to start using his arm. "You're a fast learner, buddy," his occupational therapist told him when he had mastered closing the hand around a toothbrush. Brad was a big Assiniboine guy, only a couple of years older than Andy and relentlessly enthusiastic. "Tomorrow you can try dressing yourself." "Well, fast is relative." Andy put the toothbrush down, then tried to pick it up again and knocked it off the table. Brad smiled but didn't make a move for the fallen toothbrush. "It's a process, eh? Your muscles have new roles to learn. Besides, once you get through these things, the real fun begins with that rig." The real fun would be interesting if he ever got there. The special features. He would have to learn to interpret the signal from the camera on the wrist, feeding straight to his head. There were flashlights and body telemetry readings to turn off and on. He looked forward to the real test for those features. Seeing into the dark corners of an engine, turning a breech calf. Those were lessons worth sticking around for. Andy bent down and concentrated on closing his hand on the toothbrush handle. Excuse me. Just before he was due to go home, an infection sank its teeth in under his armpit. The doctor gave him antibiotics and drained the fluid. That night, awash in fever, he dreamed his arm was a highway. The feeling stuck with him when he woke. Andy had never wanted much. He had wanted Lori to love him forever and ever, but she didn't, and that was that. As a child, he'd asked for the calf with the blue eyes, Maisie, and he kept her until she was big enough to be sold. And that was that. He'd never considered doing anything except working his own land next to his parents and taking over theirs when they retired. There was no point in wanting much else. Now, he wanted to be a road, or his right arm did. It wanted with a fierceness that left him baffled, a wordless yearning that came from inside him and outside him at once. No more than that. It didn't just, no, more than that. It didn't just want to be a road. It knew it was one. Specifically, a stretch of asphalt 2 lanes wide, 97 kilometers long, in eastern Colorado. A stretch that could see all the way to the mountains, but was content not to reach them. Cattle guards on either side, barbed wire, grassland. Andy had never been to Colorado. He'd never been out of Saskatchewan, not even to Calgary or Winnipeg. He'd never seen a mountain. The fact that he was able to describe the contours of the mountains in the distance and the tag numbers in the ears of the bald-faced cows told him he wasn't imagining things. He was himself, and he was also a road. "You ready to go back to work, buddy? How's it feeling?" Brad asked him. Andy shrugged. He knew he should tell Brad about the road, but he didn't want to stay in the hospital any longer. Bad enough that his parents had been forced to finish his harvest, grumbling the whole time about his archaic machinery. There was no way he could risk a delay.
"Infection's gone, but it's talking a lot. Still takes some getting used to,"
he said, and that was true. It fed him the temperature, the levels of different pollutants in the air, It warned him when he was pushing himself too hard on the treadmill. And then there was the road thing. Brad tapped his own forehead. You remember how to dial back the input if it gets too much. Yeah, I'm good. Brad smiled and reached for a cooler he had brought with him. Well, great, man. In that case, today you're going to work on eggs.
Eggs?
You're a farmer, right? You have to pick up eggs without cracking them, and then you have to make lunch. Believe me, this is expert level, harder than any of that fancy stuff. You master eggs with that hand, you graduate. Brad and the doctors finally gave him permission to leave a week later. You want to drive? Asked his father, holding out the keys to Andy's truck. Andy shook his head and walked around to the passenger side. I'm not sure I could shove into second gear. Might need to trade this in for an automatic. His father gave him once over. Maybe so. Or just practice a bit around the farm. I'm not scared. Just careful. Fair enough, fair enough. His father started the truck. He wasn't scared, but it was more than being careful. At first, the joy of being in his own house eclipsed the weird feeling, the road feeling. He kept up the exercises he had learned in physical therapy. They had retaught him how to shave and cook and bathe, and he retaught himself how to groom and tack the horses. He met up with his buddies from his old hockey team at the bar in town to try to prove that everything was normal. Gradually, the aches grew wider. How could you be a road? In a particular place, and yet not be in that place. Nothing felt right. He had always loved to eat, but now food was tasteless. He forced himself to cook, to chew, to swallow. He set goals for the number of bites he had to take before stopping. He had lost muscle in the hospital, but now he grew thinner. His new body was wiry instead of solid. Never much of a mirror person, he started making himself look. Motivation, maybe. A way to try to communicate with his own brain. He counted his ribs, the synthetic sleeving that smoothed the transition from pectorals to artificial arm gapped a little because of his lost mass. If anything was worth notifying the doctors about, it was that. Gaps led to chafing, they had said. Then down the slippery slope to irritation and abrasion and infection. You don't work a horse with a harness sore. In the mirror, he saw his gaunt face, his narrowed shoulder, the sleeve, his left arm with its jagged love letter. On the right side, he saw road. A trick of the mind, a glitch in the software, shoulder, road. He knew it was all there. The pincer hand, the metal bones, the wire sinew. He opened and closed the hand. It was still there, but it was gone at the same time. He scooped grain for the horses with his road hand, ran his left over their shaggy winter coats. He oiled machinery with his road hand, tossed hay bales and bags of grain with both arms working together, worked on his truck in the garage. Other trucks made their slow way down a snowy highway in Colorado that was attached to him by wire, by electrode, by artificial pathways that had somehow found their way from his brain to his heart. He lay down on his frozen driveway, arms at his sides, and felt the trucks rumble through. The thaw came late to both of Andy's places. The farm and the highway. He had hoped the bustle of spring might bring relief, but instead he felt even more divided. He tried to explain the feeling to Susan over a beer on her tiny screen porch. She had moved back to town while he was in the hospital, rented a tiny apartment on top of the tattoo parlor. A big-bellied stove took up most of the porch, letting her wear tank tops even this early in the season. Her arms were timelines, a progression of someone else's skills. Her own progression must be on other arms, back in Vancouver. She had gone right after high school to apprentice herself to some tattooed big shot. Andy couldn't figure out why she had returned, but here she was, back again. The sleeves of his jacket hid his own arms. Not that he was hiding anything. He held the beer in his left hand now only because his right hand dreamed of asphalt and tumbleweeds. He didn't want to bother it. "Maybe it's recycled," Susan said. "Maybe it used to belong to some Colorado rancher." Andy shook his head. "It isn't in the past, and it isn't a person on the road." "Well, the software then? Maybe that's the recycled part. Maybe the chip was meant for one of those new smart roads near Toronto, the ones that drive your car for you." "Maybe." He drained the beer, then dropped the can to the porch and crushed it with the heel of his work boot. He traced his scars with his fingertips, first the scalp, then across and down his chest, where metal joined to flesh. "Are you going to tell anybody else?" Susan asked. He listened to the crickets, the undertones of frogs. He knew Susan was hearing those too. He didn't think she heard the road thrumming in his arm. "Nah, not for now." Andy's arm was more in Colorado every day. He struggled to communicate with it. It worked fine. It was just elsewhere. Being a road wasn't so bad once he got used to it. People say a road goes to and from places, but it doesn't. A road is where it is every moment of the day. He thought about driving south, riding around until he could prove whether or not the place actually existed, but he couldn't justify leaving after all that time in the hospital. Fields needed to be tilled and turned and seeded. Animals needed to be fed and watered. He had no time for road trips, no matter how important the trip or the road. Susan dragged him to a bonfire out at the Oakley farm. He didn't want to go, hadn't been to a party since he had bought his own land, but she was persuasive. "I gotta reconnect with my client base, and I don't feel like getting hit on the whole time," she said. He hung his robot arm out the window to catch the wind as she drove. Wind 21 kilometers per hour, it told him, 12 degrees Celsius. In the other place, 5 centimeters of rain had fallen in the last 2 hours. 3 vehicles had driven through. The bonfire was already going in a clearing by the barn, the crowd around it shivering. Doug Oakley was a year older than Andy, Hugh still in high school. They both lived with their parents, which meant this was a parents-out-of-town party. Most of the parties Andy had ever been to were like this, except he had been on the younger side of the group then. He had been on the younger side of the group then instead of the older side. There's a point at which you're the cool older guy. Then, after that, you're the weird older guy who shouldn't be hanging around with high school kids anymore. He was pretty sure he'd crossed that line. Susan had bought a case of Molson to make friends and influence people. She hoisted it out of the back seat now and emptied the beers into a cooler in the grass. She took one for herself and tossed one to him, but it bounced off his new hand. He glanced around to see if anybody had noticed. He shoved that can deep into the ice and freed another one from the cooler. He held it in the pincer and popped the top with his left, then drained half of it in one chug. The beer was cold and the air was cold, and he wished he had brought a heavier jacket. At least he could hold the drink in his metal hand, his own insulator. The high school girls all congregated by the porch. Most of them had plastic cups instead of cans for mixing Clamato with their beer. Susan looked at them and snorted. "If I live to be 200, I will never understand that combination." They walked toward the fire. It blazed high, but its heat didn't reach far beyond the first circle of people knotted around it. Andy shifted from foot to foot, trying to get warm, breathing in wood smoke. He looked at the faces, recognizing most of them. The Oakley boys, of course, and their girlfriends. They always had girlfriends. Doug had been engaged at one point, and now he wasn't. Andy tried to remember details. His mother would know. Then he realized that the girl on Doug's arm now was Lori. Nothing wrong with that. Doug was a nice guy, but Lori had always talked about university. Andy had soothed his broken heart by saying she deserved more than a farmer's life. It hurt him a little to see her standing in the glow of the flame, her hands in her armpits. He didn't mind that he was still there, but he didn't think she ought to be. Or maybe she was just leaning against Doug for warmth. It wasn't his business anymore, he supposed. Lori slipped from under Doug's arm and into the crowd. She appeared next to Susan a moment later. "Hey," she said, raising a hand in greeting, then slipping it back under her armpit, either out of awkwardness or cold. She looked embarrassed. "Hey," he replied, nodding his beer toward her with the robot hand. He tried to make it a casual movement. Only a little beer sloshed out of the can. "I heard about your arm, Andy. I felt terrible. I'm sorry I didn't call, but the semester got busy." She trailed off. It was a lousy excuse, but his smile was genuine. "It's cool, I understand. Are you still in university?" "Yeah, Winnipeg. I've got one more semester." "Well, what are you majoring in?" Susan asked. "Physics, but I'll be going to grad school for meteorology, climate science." "Awesome. You know what would make a cool tattoo for a climate scientist?" Andy excused himself to get another beer. When he came back, Susan was drawing a barometer on the back of Lori's hand. She and Lori had never been close, but they had gotten on okay. Susan had liked that Lori had ambition, and Lori had liked dating a guy whose best friend was a girl, which she said was pretty unusual. If they had moved to the same city, CTV could have made some cheesy buddy comedy about them. The small town valedictorian and the small town lesbian punk in the big city. He would make a one-time appearance as the guy who stayed behind. After his fifth beer, he couldn't feel anything but the road in his sleeve. The air in Colorado smelled like ozone, like maybe a storm was about to hit. That night, after Susan had drawn marker tattoos onto several of their former classmates and invited them to stop at her shop, after promises of email were exchanged with Lori, after the hazy drive home, he dreamed the highway had taken him over entirely. In the nightmare, the road crept up past his arm, past his shoulder. It paved his heart, flattened his limbs, tarred his mouth and eyes, so that he woke up, gasping, before dawn. He set up an appointment with a therapist. Dr. Bird's broad face was young, but her hair was completely silver white. She nodded sympathetically as she listened. "I'm not really here to give my opinion, but I think maybe you were rushed into this BCI thing. You didn't have a part in the decision. You didn't have any time to get used to the idea of having no arm." "Did I need to get used to that?" "Well, some people do. Some people don't have a choice because their bodies need to heal before regular prosthetics can be fitted." What she said made sense, but it didn't explain anything. It would have explained phantom pains or dreams that his arm was choking him. He had read about those kinds of things, but a road? None of her theories jived. He drove home on Flat Prairie Highway, then Flat Prairie Two-Lane, between fallow fields and grazing land. The road to his parents' farm and his own parcel of land in back of theirs was dirt. His new truck had lousy shock absorbers, and every rut jolted him on the beat, on the bench. He had lived here his whole life, but his arm was convinced it belonged someplace else. On the way home, it spoke to him without words. It pulled him. "Turn around," it said. "South, south, west. I am here and I am not here," he thought. Or maybe it thought. "I love my home," he tried to tell it. Even as he said it, he longed for the completion of being where he was, both Saskatchewan and Colorado. This was not a safe way to be. Nobody could live in two places at once. It was a dilemma. He couldn't leave his farm, not unless he sold it. And the only part of him that agreed with that plan was not really part of him at all. That night, he dreamed he was driving the combine through his canola field when it jammed. He climbed down to fix it, and this time it took his prosthetic. It chewed the metal and the wire, and he found himself hoping it would just rip the whole thing from his body clear up to his brain so he could start afresh. But then it did keep going. It didn't stop with the arm. It tore and it ripped, and he felt a tug in his head that turned into a throbbing, then a sharper pain. The pain didn't go away when he woke. He thought it was a hangover, but no hangover had ever felt like that. He made it to the bathroom to throw up, then crawled back to his cell phone by the bed to call his mother. The last thing he thought of before he passed out was that Brad had never taught him how to crawl on the prosthetic. It worked pretty well. He woke in the hospital again. He checked his hands first, left still there, right still robot. With the left, he felt along the familiar edges of the prosthetic and the sleeve. Everything was still there. His hand went up to his head, where it encountered bandages. He tried to lift the prosthetic, but it didn't move. A nurse entered the room. "You're awake," she said, with a West Indian lilt. "Your parents went home, but they'll be back after feeding time," they said. "Well, what happened?" he asked. "Pretty bad infection around the chip in your head, so they took it out. Good news is that the electrodes all scan fine. They'll give you a new chip when the swelling goes down, and you'll be using that fine bit of machinery again in no time." She opened the window shade. From the bed, all Andy saw was sky, blue and serene. The best sky to work under. He looked down at the metal arm again and realized that for the first time in months he saw the arm and not Colorado. He could still bring the road, his road, to mind, but he was no longer there. He felt a pang of loss. Well, that was that, then. When the swelling went down, a new chip was installed in his head. He waited for this one to assert itself, to tell him his arm was a speedboat or a satellite or an elephant's trunk. But he was alone in his head again. His hand followed his directions, hand-like, open, close, no cows, no dust, no road. He asked Susan to get him from the hospital, partly so his parents wouldn't have to disrupt their schedules again, and partly because he had something to ask her. In her car, driving home, he rolled up his left sleeve. "Remember this?" he asked. She glanced at it in a flash. "How could I forget? I'm sorry, Andy. Nobody should go through life with a tattoo that awful." "It's okay. I was just wondering, well, if maybe you'd fix it, change it." "Well, God, I'd love to. You're the worst advertisement my business could have. Got anything in mind?" He did. He looked at the jagged letters. The I of Lori could easily be turned into an A. The whole name disappeared into Colorado. It was up to him to remember. Somewhere in some wet medical waste bin back in Saskatoon, there is a computer chip that knew it was a road. A chip that was an arm that was Andy, who was a stretch of asphalt, 2 lanes wide, 97 kilometers long, in eastern Colorado. A stretch that could see all the way to the mountains, but was content not to reach them. Forever and ever. Oh, you listen at Goodnight Norman. Monday morning, May 15th, the Ides of May, and I'm reading Sarah Pinsker's, Sooner or Later, Everything Falls into the Sea. That story was called A Stretch of Highway, 2 lanes wide, if my calculations are correct. I'm just a little over halfway through this pony ride. And I'm going to read another one of the stories in this book. read that one. Okay, I'm going to read Talking with Dead People. Yes, I was the one who came up with the name House of Wax, as in Lizzie Borden took an axe. Like I was someone who could joke about that kind of thing, and yeah, it's true that Elizabeth Mint offered me a partnership in the business and I turned her down. We were college roommates, and I feel comfortable saying I had no business sense whatsoever. If I had seen the same potential in the idea that she did, if I had taken her up on the offer, if I hadn't called it quits on working with her, I would be a millionaire now. She called herself Eliza then, made sure you knew it was Eliza and nothing else. She had a weird love-hate relationship with the whole Lizzie Borden thing. Her family lived in South Jersey when she was a kid, and she was a Lizzie then without anyone making a fuss about it. They moved an hour upstate to Teaneck right before she started high school, right when that big Lizzie Borden movie came out. The next thing she knew, she was Lizzie from Bordentown, and everyone was going around asking her how her parents were. After 4 years of teasing, she was happy to get a fresh start in college. Despite all that, or maybe because of it, the story held a fascination for her. I didn't understand it, but I was used to sharing space with people who couldn't let something go. She dragged me on more than one road trip from Rochester to Fall River, Mass. Dragged me to some other creepy places, too. Abandoned sanatoriums, murder sites, serial killer homes. I had no idea how many people made pilgrimages to those places. At least Eliza's interest was pragmatic. Not that I knew it at first. I went along because she paid for gas, and I had never been more than 100 miles from home. Having somebody who wanted to go places with me was a novelty, too. Though in retrospect, that may have been her own self-interest, reflecting on me. On the way back from one of those places in my old Ford Fiesta, she was the only money person I ever met who didn't drive. She always sat silent while I searched my phone for the cheeriest songs I could think of. Then the questions inevitably came. Oops. Hey, Gwenny, why do you think there was no water in the swimming pool? It's October. Not now, then. He was found in an empty swimming pool in July. I'd mull it over. Do they know whether it was empty before or after he wound up in there? Well, he didn't drown or fall in. He was dead already. Weren't you paying attention? The answer to that was always no. I'd had enough of murders and missing people by then. I wandered through the sites with the goal of learning as little as possible about the mystery at hand. The whole thing felt voyeuristic to me, lurid to my mind. What went on behind a family's closed doors wasn't meant to be seen, much less solved. Instead of paying attention to the clues, I concentrated on the architecture, interior design, gardening, art. I studied the books on the bookshelves, the furniture, the cutlery. I imagined how I'd replicate them in miniature if I were adding that house to the train towns I'd built in my parents' basement. She'd answer her own question after a while. I'll bet the pool was empty because somebody had convinced old Mr. Hager that there was some expensive repair that needed to be done while the rest of the family was on vacation. Maybe somebody convinced him that a whole bunch of things needed fixing. The pool needed to be drained, and that he had to pay in advance. Then the family got home and discovered he'd been taken advantage of, and that's what brought down the most popular American politician of the 21st century, a scam. They had money. How does that explain his own son in the pool, or Senator Haygood disappearing for 3 weeks? I didn't need to pay attention on the tour to know any of that. If you don't see it, I'm not going to spell it out, Gwen. Then I'd skip to a song I could sing along with, and before too long, she'd apologize and change the subject to make me stop singing. She covered all this in the memoir, the road trips and the questions she asked herself afterwards, though she left me out of that part. More introspection, less interrogation. I pretty much got one scene in the book. In her telling, we were on the Mass Pike, an hour into the six-hour drive back to school from Fall River, when she turned to me and said, "What if we could ask them questions?" In real life, I said, "Who?" And she said, "Them, you know." And I said, "I have no idea what you're talking about." And then we played a round of total exasperation. She tightened up the conversation and talking with dead people for clarity's sake. In her version, she said, "What if we could ask them questions?" The fictionalized me, with perfect grasp of her concept, answered, "Oh, that would be awesome." What she meant, of course, was, "What if we gave them a voice?" That was her idea, asking questions of murderers and monsters and the unjustly accused. "Like a seance?" I suggested when I got her implication, also after a much briefer period in her book than in real life. "A seance, but better. You go to Fall River and ask Lizzie Borden actual questions and get actual answers in reply." I humored her. "And you could call it House of Wax. Get it? Wax? That's the best idea you've ever had." I could hear the grin behind her words. For the rest of the drive, we tried to come up with better names, but that one stuck from the beginning. The name helped focus the project, too. I think her original idea had been animatronic bust of the killers, which to her mind was cool, and to mine was a cross between the Hall of Presidents and the Oz witch with the interchangeable heads. Creepy as hell. Uncanny. She might have stuck with that, but for the fact we didn't know anybody who made the type of sculptures needed to bring those busts to life. Eliza was always good at adapting to what was on hand, and what was on hand was me. Model making was always my thing. First broccoli tree dioramas and ranch dressing dyed river blue. Then whole train towns in the basement with my parents before my brother Tristan disappeared. Then every shop and engineering class my high school offered, making murder houses, wasn't that different. The architectural models I construct now aren't that different either, for that matter. People ask, why houses? Why not the people themselves? The answer is, we had a choice between faked-looking models of people or real-looking models of houses. I built the first one in the campus theater set shop, where I had my work-study gig that year. It was a good job. I liked making things, and I liked that the schedule was a sporadic one, even if that meant I never had much money. Nothing new there. The prototype was the Borden House, of course, not Maplecroft, her later home, 92 Second Street. On all our visits, Eliza made reservations for us at the bed and breakfast that operates there now. She'd book early enough to request the room where Lizzie's stepmother was found murdered. I'd always wandered the halls with an eye toward the house itself rather than the murders, but once she'd explained my role in her plan, I paid even more attention. The stairs' width, the orientation of the windows to the day's changing sunlight. It was easy enough to find floor plans and photos online, but my own experience of rooms and hallways suffused the project. "Jesus, Gwen," said Eliza when I showed her the model she commissioned. The west wall swung open on hinges. Every room was in there in perfect proportion. Tiny replicas of the murder couch, the mirrors, the railings, functional windows and doors. It stood a foot tall, not including the base, which added about 4 inches. The Borden House didn't have electricity, so I installed big miniature gas lamps on the tables and the walls. "It's what you asked for, right?" "Well, yeah, but how long did it take you?" I added up the days and the hours in my head and then shrugged. She'd been working on the programming and the electronics for exactly as long as I'd been building models. She bought my supplies as I worked on it, too, so she ought to know. She turned it around, peered in through the windows. "She made all the furniture," she whispered to herself, like I couldn't hear her. "Amazing." I had left the base hollow, as she'd requested, and she skipped classes the next day to add her electronics. When I got back to the room after dinner, she was lying on her bed reading. "Turn it on," she said, rolling over to face me. Her desk was always a mess in stark contrast to mine. The model sat in the center with tools scattered around it. One shutter was missing, which gave me a pang of anxiety. I felt around on the base until I found a switch. Nothing happened. "Now what?" I asked. "Well, ask her a question." Nothing came to mind, and after a moment, Eliza groaned and asked in my place, "Abby, which way were you facing when you were attacked?" I peered into the house, half expecting to see figures. "Wait, why Abby? I thought you were questioning Lizzie." "Well, when we switched to houses instead of bust, I realized we could put everyone in there." She repeated her question. A woman's voice came through the speakers. I recognized Eliza's friend, Angie. "I was facing my attacker." "Abby, where was the first place you were hit?" "I was hit in the guest room." I giggled, and Eliza gave me a hatchet-shaped look. This was a glitch. "Abby," she tried again, "where was the first place on your body you were hit?" "I was hit on the side of my head." Eliza smiled in triumph and continued, "Andrew, where did you go when you left the house the morning of your death?" A male voice now, one I didn't recognize. A professor, maybe? The voice sounded older than our friend's. "I went for my morning walk." "Who attacked you?" I asked. No answer. "You have to use a first name," Eliza said. I felt suddenly shy, formal. "Mr. Borden, who attacked you?"
"I was asleep."
I cocked my head at Eliza. "What happens if I ask Mrs. Borden that question? Or if I ask Lizzie directly?" "Try it." "Lizzie Borden, did you kill the people you were accused of killing?" Lizzie Borden answered in Eliza's awful attempt at a Massachusetts accent. "I was acquitted of those crimes." The same voice, lying on the other bed, said, "Cool, huh?" Something tapped against the window behind my bed. A bee caught between the screen and the glass. I crossed the room to free it. It glanced off the window a couple more times before bumbling its way down the side of the building. I flopped onto my bed. "I still don't get it," I said. "It doesn't know any more than anybody else does. It can only say what you programmed it to say. If you don't know who did it, it won't know either." Eliza sighed. "This is a prototype. It can only answer questions I programmed in. But I'm pretty sure that I could give the AI enough information. If I feed it every single known detail about every victim and every suspect, I can get it to a point where it'll be able to answer questions I don't know the answer to. Make connections I haven't made, based on what's been input. Maybe. And even if it doesn't, people will buy it anyway." "But what's the point?" "People love unsolved murder," she said, a line she repeated and expanded upon in her memoir. "And they love murder houses. We are going to make these and sell them to murder house museums. This one's museum quality. Then we're going to make smaller, cheaper ones without furniture or tiny working shutters that fall off when I'm soldering." That stung more than I let on. Nothing fell off my models if they were handled right. My little brother Tristan wrecked more than his share before he wasn't around to do that anymore, but the fault was never my workmanship. "We, huh? We!" I stood and poked around the desk until I found the missing shutter amid Eliza's clutter. Fished among my model supplies for the tiny pin that would secure it back in place. "The other voices are good, but your Lizzie sounds fake." 2 weeks later, she updated the base. The house gave a wider variety of answers. She replaced her own voice with someone who sounded more like the accents we heard in Fall River. On spring break, while I was home, she took a bus to Massachusetts with the house on her lap. She sold it to a general store in town for $1,000. She tossed the money on my bed my first day back at school. They paid her online, but she'd taken it out of the bank in 20s. "Gwenny, I need to know if we're partners in this." "I thought we already were." "We can be. I need you to build the models, but I see a couple of ways this can go. Either we're partners and we both put up money to get this business growing and we both make decisions and we split everything 50-50,
or you let me pay for the models, but it's my business. Well, how much would you pay me for the models? That first one was a work of art. We'll need a few more like that. I got a list of houses, then some mini versions with no frills, no furniture, no working shutters. For the big ones, you get $600 each, plus materials. For the little ones, $50 each. I pay you for each one, regardless of whether I was able to sell it or not. There's $900 in that stack for your hard work on the first one. None of this could happen if I hadn't been able to sell that first one. You can have $900 for it if you want to just work for hire. Otherwise, I'll take that money back and invest it in the next step, and we're 50-50 partners. Succeed or fail, equal share. I looked at the bills stacked on my bed. I'd never seen that much money in my life, and she knew it. My parents weren't particularly well off, and after the police stopped looking for Tristan, they spent every penny on private investigators. $900 would let me buy new tires and a muffler for my car. With more payments like that, I could cover my own fees for the next semester and not need to ask my parents for money they didn't have. Or I could partner with her. But if nobody actually wanted to buy tiny murder houses with tiny murder voices, I'd be left with said murder houses. Money for work, no accountability, or money for a share, with a stake I wasn't sure I could afford not to pocket. I'll work for you, I said. She reached into her bag and pulled out a contract. Let's make it official, then. I never found out whether there was a second contract for if I'd answered the other way. People love solving mysteries, she wrote in her book. It makes them feel smart. She had a lot of ideas about what people liked and didn't like, maybe because she saw everybody else as extensions of herself. That part isn't in her book, of course. That's my own theory. We turned our dorm room. Into a production factory. When the orders started coming in, she rented space in a warehouse, and we moved everything there. It was a sauna in summer and freezing in winter, but nobody complained. She hired other friends to handle different aspects of the business, including a cast of voice actors and a couple of electronics people. Mo Barra painted my models. Samia Gilman built us a website and established a social media presence. Whatever the reason, Eliza was right. People wanted murder houses. Just a few at first, but then someone solved the Haygood murder of 2021 using our model. Got the case reopened. Found a way to prove their hypothesis using the actual evidence. Exonerated the family. Senator Haygood even wrote to thank us. After that, the orders came in faster than we could fill them. The waiting list only made them more desirable. We offered a range of houses we could assemble in bulk quantities, then another, higher price tier for custom jobs. We did a Lindbergh, a Ramsey. I saved up enough money to pay my own tuition the next semester, since I was making more than anyone other than Eliza. Once in a while, I wondered if I'd made a mistake in not taking the partnership. I still wonder. I think I would have enjoyed the houses she built for forensic schools and the FBI, the case study puzzles they commissioned, like the nutshell studies down in Maryland. But with voices and an AI that could follow lines of questioning. I would have been on board with the murder house owners who paid Eliza for AIs that wired into intercoms or smartphones so they could change charge admission to people walking through the actual rooms. Even if we hadn't fallen out when we did, we'd probably have fought over some of the other commissioned work she took, which I would have refused. Sensationalist TV shows that licensed our houses to provoke and harass people who had long since been acquitted. Dictators. Current cases. Things that felt too raw to be examined. At the same time, my reason for wanting to stay with work for hire was simpler. I saw how much time Eliza spent on all the aspects that weren't craft. I was happy enough making my models and ignoring the business side. We probably could have continued that way indefinitely if she hadn't gone and done the thing that ended our friendship. She didn't include that anecdote in talking with dead people either. In the book, she skips from our frigid warehouse space to her dropping out before senior year. What she omitted was her present to me on my 20th birthday. Our birthdays were fairly close, so all three of the Decembers we roomed together, we threw a joint party just before winter exams. Crowded and intimate, filled with our friends and business partners, more or less the same people. She drank Jenny Light, I drank cider. I even remember that detail, mostly because later that night I got sick to my stomach,
and I haven't been able to touch cider since. Anyway, a few drinks in, she stood up on my desk and called for attention. Somebody, Mubara, I think, though that part is hazy, somebody handed her a canvas shopping bag. She plugged in a cable dangling from it before she passed it to me. I remember that too, so I already knew what sort of present it was, even if I didn't know the specifics. I pulled it from the shopping bag. With its plywood base, 2 feet by 1 foot, and sewing machine-sized building, it was much larger than even my high-end models. The details were crude, and it took me a minute to recognize my own childhood home. But when I did, I had a pretty clear idea what she'd done. In a shaky voice, not yet slurring, I asked the model, "What's your name?" A voice from inside, not mine, since I hadn't recorded this particular surprise, answered, "Gwen." I couldn't tell who it was. One of the acting school kids we sometimes paid to do the job, probably. I looked over at Eliza then. I don't know why she expected me to be excited that she had programmed my life's details as she knew them into an AI box. I guess maybe she wouldn't have minded one of herself to interrogate and get her own answers back, so she didn't understand how I wouldn't feel the same. But I looked at her, and in that moment I think she realized that maybe it had been a mistake. I glared until the smile died on her face. Too late, though. People were already pushing past to ask the fake me questions. Did I sleep with Kaz Mendelsohn last year? What about Samia? Did I really flunk ethics and engineering? The answers were eerily correct. No, yes, no. I got an extension to finish it over the summer because I'd been too busy making murder houses. And the professor knew... And the professor said I could turn in an essay on the ethics of making murder houses, which I did. These were all things Eliza knew about me from 2.5 years in close proximity. The voice, though not my own, carried my speech patterns and my inflections. The questions took other turns. I waited for the voice to make a mistake, to prove it wasn't me. But it knew my home address, my parents' names, the name of my favorite teacher in high school. I pictured Eliza secretly reaching out to my family, my online friends, asking them if they wanted to be in on a birthday surprise. I'll bet if anyone said they didn't think I enjoyed surprises, she probably just fed that information into the AI, too. How many siblings do you have? Somebody asked, and I think I stopped breathing. They were just asking random questions, I told myself. None, the AI said, and then paused. None anymore. I grabbed my backpack from under my bed and made sure I had keys and wallet and computer and walked out the door. I could have stayed and kicked everyone else out, but I left them interrogating me. All I knew was that I had to go before I heard any follow-up questions, or worse yet, answers. I tried knocking on some doors to find a place to crash, but everybody was either at our party or gone from campus already. Freezing rain fell as I headed for my car, but it wasn't unbearably cold. My father made me keep an emergency blanket in the trunk, and I pulled my arms and legs up into my clothes. I woke up in the middle of the night to vomit by my back tire, slipping on the ice that had accumulated and nearly wiping out in my own sick. I stayed in other people's rooms for the rest of the exam period and applied to move over the winter break. The school assigned me to another junior whose roommate was studying in Rome for the spring. I knew I was leaving the company in the lurch in terms of models, but at that point I didn't care. I was done with murder houses, done with AI voices that knew too much. In my ethics essay, I justified what we were doing. In some cases, we're giving voice to the voiceless, I wrote,